Good afternoon. Thanks for being here for this year's first edition of our annual University Colloquium Series. It's great to have you all here. I think we'll go ahead and get started. I expect there will be people who continue to straggle in as classes end and so on. We have a good kickoff event this year. Marty Eads, one of our own faculty, is going to be talking. Looking around the room, I expect most of you know Marty, but I'm going to go ahead and give an introduction anyway. You might not know all the facts. Marty Eads has been here at EMU in the English department since 2003. Before that, did some teaching at Valparaiso University, and interestingly enough, at the North Carolina Correctional Institution for Women. And I know she's also done some work here in teaching in correctional institutions here in Virginia, and also as a graduate student at UNC Chapel Hill. She received her PhD from North Carolina in 2001, before that an MA in religion in 1993, as well as doing some study in theology and literature at the University of Durham in England. As I was reviewing the CV and reading through all of Marty's titles, it occurred to me that what I really want to do is take a week or two off and give myself my own mini-seminar in the Marty Eads oeuvre, because there's really a lot of interesting titles here. So either you're a very interesting person and writer, or you're very good at writing titles, but I'm intrigued. There's just a really interesting variety of topics and authors that she has written about. And I know she's currently starting some new work on slave literature, which hasn't actually shown up in her CV yet. So she goes from one interesting topic to the next. I'm particularly intrigued to hear what she has to say to us today about Leonard, Loretta, and Handel. So Marty, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Fred, and thank you all for coming. You'll see I have tissue up here because there's a passage in this, an excerpt that I'll be reading, that made me a little weepy this morning, and I thought, I may just cry, so be prepared. I know, what do they say, triggers are all in the news, trigger warnings, and in seriousness, I do want to say before I begin that I'm quoting some material that has quite a bit of profanity in it. So if you are trying to keep your ears pure, and you'd like to excuse yourself before I get started, I will not be offended. But I am including it just to kind of give you the flavor of the character who uses this kind of language. But again, welcome. I'm very happy to be here this afternoon. I'm happy to have had a sabbatical on which to report, and happy that you came today to learn a bit about Ron Rash's phenomenal fiction, which became the focus of much of my time and energy during my break from classroom commitments last fall. I'll be speaking today about reading Ron Rash's short stories with men at the Gemeinschaft home, and then about my subsequent more formal research on one of his novels, The World Made Straight. Before doing so, though, I would like to thank Mike Medley, my department chair. I'm not sure if he's here yet, but I think he's coming. And our colleagues in the Language and Literature Department who supported my having a change in routine, as well as Deirdre, Fred, and members of the 2014-15 Faculty Status Committee who approved my project. I'm also grateful to Marty King, who's at the control panel today. To Dawn Nice, who's probably not here, but she continues to provide me with outstanding support from her post in the Interlibrary Loan Office. And also my husband, Christopher, whose example of continuing intellectual inquiry inspires me to keep challenging myself. Now, some of you may know already that one of my sabbatical goals was to return to working with folks who have been incarcerated. And as Fred mentioned, before coming to EMU, I had taught for two semesters at the North Carolina Correctional Center for Women through UNC Chapel Hill's Extension Program, and taken part in Yoke Fellows Prison Ministry programs in men's institutions near Chapel Hill and in Durham, England. Since moving to Harrisonburg, however, my interaction with people in the correctional system had been limited to interaction with some folks who came to my Sunday school class at Lindale Mennonite Church. It's this class called, not the Rolling Stones, but the Living Stones, has included Gemeinschaft residents, alumni, and staff, as well as visitors from Harrisonburg's Men's Diversion Center. So as I was beginning to think about sabbatical, I was thrilled when one of my Sunday school classmates, Jenny Amison, mentioned that she could use more programming at the women's prison in Goochland, where she was working at that time. And I thought all of a sudden, I have someplace interesting to go for sabbatical, and it won't require me to uproot Christopher, who works a real job, nor for us to have a long-distance marriage for a semester. So Jenny and I schemed for about 8 months, but when August 2015 rolled around, we learned that a communication breakdown with an overworked administrator had left me without clearance to conduct the weekly course I'd had in mind. January should be enough time to get the clearance, the administrator told me, maybe sooner. Well, since my sabbatical was only scheduled to last from August to December, I decided, with Jenny's blessing, thank goodness, to cut my losses. And I contacted people at several other correctional facilities and was delighted to get an almost immediate response from Richie Yowell at Gemeinschaft. Come in. I prepared a sales pitch for our meeting a few days later and was amazed when Richie practically gave me my own spiel as he outlined his hopes for a literature course. He was convinced that inviting ex-offenders to study literary texts about trauma could help them reflect on their own traumatic pasts in non-threatening and perhaps even healing ways. Thanks to Mike Medley, who had challenged me to take a CJP course during my sabbatical, I shared Richie's conviction. I had completed the first level of STAR training 2 months before my meeting with Richie, believing that trauma awareness would help me work with the women in the women's prison at Goochland, because I knew that most of them were likely to be well acquainted with trauma. Of course, many men in the correctional system are in similar circumstances, so Richie proposed making my course a required therapeutic meeting for all Gemeinschaft residents who were not in work assignments on Thursday nights. In other words, I had a captive audience of about 40 men every week from early September through early November. And here's the flyer that we put together to try to generate interest in the course. The reading list and the lesson plan that I'd had in mind for the women's units had to change, though, because I would only have an hour a week rather than three with the guys, and nearly all of them had exhausting jobs off-site that made doing conventional homework unrealistic. I concluded that a book club format would be plenty ambitious in this setting and decided to start with North Carolina poet and fiction writer Ron Rash's recent short story collection, Something Rich and Strange. The men and I launched our first meeting by reading aloud a darkly hilarious story about a poor guy whose wife refuses to forgive him for accidentally killing their pet monkey, Little Napoleon, in the clothes dryer, and subsequently leaves him for their veterinarian slash pet psychologist. Our conversation about this story was lively, as you might expect, but only a few men came the next week prepared to discuss the assignment that I had given them. So we developed a pattern of reading aloud as the semester unfolded, and we had to be flexible as the guys left Gemeinschaft and new ones joined us. I soon observed that a few men were avid readers. They always did the homework, and they would just throw themselves into taking parts and doing readers' theater kinds of productions. But many more, as you might expect, had limited academic preparation or little energy for study after long shifts at the poultry plant. Even so, they were generally good sports about our meetings and almost without exception, at least as well-mannered as my first-year EMU writing students. I never had to ask them to stop texting. As the weeks passed, several men told me that even though they didn't much like to read, Ron Rash's book was coming to mean something to them. As dusk fell earlier and the weather grew colder, we moved on to tougher tales that explore such issues as survivor's guilt, child neglect, and substance abuse. On a few occasions, debate about characters' motivations and choices grew heated, and I was so thankful that Ms. Shirley Stewart-Jones, who's here today, an MA in counseling student completing internship hours at Gemeinschaft Home, had joined us. She had said, if you don't mind, I'll come. The guys know me, and they will behave. And I was like, yes, okay, they don't know me yet. So I would drive Miss Shirley home each week, and we would talk with each other, and sometimes with Richie in the days that followed, about how best to support the men. When we finished the stories I had chosen in November, I asked in a course evaluation if any of the men were interested in taking our work to a higher level. Would they like to discuss Rasch's novel, The World Made Straight, over the next 4 weeks, committing to reading a quarter of the text and writing briefly about it before each meeting? Although most of the men expressed appreciation for the experience we had already had, only one wanted to engage at the level I was proposing. So Richie and I agreed that my working with just one fellow might not be prudent, and we agreed that I would wrap up the course. And so I'm very grateful that members of my Sunday school class and another Sunday school class at Lyndale helped us conclude the semester by hosting a dinner for the Gemeinschaft residents and staff in December. Although one of my goals had been to help the men think more clearly and honestly about trauma and its effects, I also wanted them to see how stories could draw us forward, particularly those stories that usher us into a heightened sense of appreciation for community and even offer us the hope of heaven. So piling our plates with home-cooked ham and hash brown casserole and applesauce cake and singing Christmas carols and hearing Pastor Dwayne, issue Jesus' invitation to join him in heaven, starting now, seemed like the right way to end the Gemeinschaft book group experience. Well, reading with the guys had unearthed elements in Rasch's short stories that I hadn't noticed before, so I was a little bit disappointed not to have them as companions as I dove into The World Made Straight. So Marty told me how to work this new thing here. Okay. So this slide is a publicity shot of the film for The World Made Straight, which is not bad, but as folks generally say, read the book, right? But it's more interesting than the book cover, so I give this to you here. I had already written about the novel for my STAR course research project and published a version of the essay in a journal called The Crescent, and you can get the URL if you're interested. But I wanted to do still more with the novel. Its writing is brilliant, but the subject matter also spoke to me on many levels. Set in Western North Carolina, not far from where I grew up, The World Made Straight features characters whose ancestors, like my own, fought on both sides of the U.S. Civil War. That unresolved historic trauma contributes to the kinds of acting in and acting out behaviors about which I had learned in STAR, some of the same behaviors that land guys in Gemeinschaft. Rasch writes powerfully yet sensitively about such people and their families in Something Rich and Strange, The World Made Straight, and elsewhere, which was part of the reason I anticipated that his fiction would speak to men in recovery. As difficult as much of Rasch's work is to read, his writing nevertheless sparks hope in me for two reasons. First, while his treatments of traumatized groups and individuals acknowledge unflinchingly that hurt people, extending circles of suffering in all directions, Rasch still communicates compassion for his characters. In most of his short stories and novels, even his most violent villains are complex. Second, his characters hunger for heaven, and that hunger reminds readers, at least those of us predisposed to be reminded, that God has instilled in us some understanding of justice and some appreciation for beauty, no matter who we are or what our circumstances. Worship scholar Stephen R. Guthrie writes about these capacities in Creator Spirit, the Holy Spirit, and the Art of Becoming Human, pointing out that a Christian eschatology asserts that history, humanity, and the cosmos look forward, not only to an ending, but to a telos, a completion, fulfillment, and a kind of perfection. To hope for the kingdom of God in its fullness is to hope for beauty, beauty from and through brokenness. Guthrie's book focuses primarily on forms of art used in Christian worship, but I believe much of his analysis also applies to Rasch's novel. God has wired us to want heaven, and The World Made Straight does a particularly good job of illustrating this reality. One of the most striking ways in which Rasch dramatizes our hunger for heaven is through his use of music in the novel. While fiction writers commonly mention musical works to help situate their stories in time and place, Rasch's references are more than incidental. He is not merely giving us a radio playlist from 1978 as background music. And some of you had a chance to enjoy Lynyrd Skynyrd as you entered. And there's more to come during the reception. So he's not just doing this to give us background for the plot. Instead, he depicts several more significant and often overlapping functions of music. First, for identity construction. second, for mood alteration, third, for manipulation of others, and fourth, for the pursuit of transcendence. To do so, he has characters engage with Southern rock and traditional country music, hymns, and even classical compositions. Some of these characters are the novel's dual protagonists, 17-year-old Travis Shelton, whose name you'll see up there, and Leonard Schuler, the history teacher turned small-time drug dealer who becomes Travis's unlikely mentor, Leonard's lover, Dina, and Leonard's nemesis, a mountaineer drug kingpin named Carlton Toomey. Other characters in the book include Carlton's equally brutal son, Hubert, Travis's parents and girlfriend, Lori, and Leonard's ex-wife, Kira, and their young daughter, Emily. And I'll just leave this up here in the hope that it will help you orient yourselves toward the characters if you haven't had a chance to read the book. By my second reading of The World Made Straight, I was intrigued by these characters' relationships to music, so I began seeking resources that would help me understand them. In The Sociology of Rock Music, which is a book published the same year that Ron Rash's novel is set, 1978, Simon Frith discusses youth such as Travis, who seek autonomy and self-esteem through peer groups and symbols of self-assertion, such as rock music, while undergoing socialization toward adulthood. Frith concludes that for most teens, music is less symbolically meaningful than it is background accompaniment to their leisure activities. He writes, "For most teenagers, leisure means having a good time, physically, irresponsibly, spontaneously. It means drinking and laughing and doing nothing and sex and trying anything once before you have to do something forever. For these young people, music itself neither satisfies needs nor symbolizes values. It is simply the noise and buoyant context for all the other activities." While he does note that most artistically successful rock music offers a genuine critique of reality and also acknowledges its power to shape young people into economic consumers, Frith nevertheless asserts that most youth themselves experience music's significance as peripheral. Travis's listening habits in The World Made Straight appear initially to illustrate Frith's conclusion. Travis is much like the members of one of the peer groups Frith studied. He calls them the unskilled boys. Their distinguishing characteristic, Frith explains, is the job mobility that reflects both their own readiness to leave when fed up and their employer's readiness to sack them for disciplinary problems. When The World Made Straight opens, Travis has just been fired for coming late repeatedly to the payload where he bags groceries. Like the youth whose music consumption Frith analyzed, Travis also cranks up rock music as he engages in leisure activities that reflect his interest in having a good time, physically, irresponsibly, spontaneously. From the novel's opening paragraph, however, Rash presents Travis's use of music not as simply the noise and buoyant context for other activities, but also as a marker of the powerful masculinity to which he aspires. Travis continually tries to disprove his father's assessment of him as puny and sickly as a baby and nothing but trouble ever since. He experiences satisfaction when, making his way to a fishing hole, a laurel branch cuts his face, making him look tougher, more dangerous, and wishing it had slashed him deeper, enough to leave a scar. He's often scared, but he takes foolish risks. Rash writes in that opening paragraph, "Travis drove fast, the rod and reel clattering in the truck bed, red dust rising in his wake. The Marlin 22 slid on its makeshift gun rack with each hard curve. He had the windows down, and if the radio worked, he would have had it blasting." Driving past a tobacco field where his father has failed to acknowledge his hard work, Travis wished he had a tape player so he could hear some fast, hard music like Skinner or Black Oak, Arkansas. Later, after the book's most painful interaction between Travis and his father and a subsequent quarrel with his girlfriend, Lori, Travis listens in his friend Shank's Plymouth Wildebeest to an Allman Brothers tape, which Rash describes as follows. "The music that had hurt his ears now seemed not loud enough, and he shouted as much to Shank, who turned the volume up until the speakers shook. The opening bass lines of Whipping Post surged through his body. He thought of his father and how he hoped the bastard was really behind in his farm work, because then the old man would realize how much Travis had done during spring planting. He imagined his father begging him come back to the farm and help get the planting done, Travis telling the old man to kiss his ass." When the tape ends, Travis orders his other buddy, Wesley, to replace it with one by Lynyrd Skynyrd featuring Freebird. Rash then describes the effect guitarist Gary Rossington's performance has on Travis. He knew musicians called their guitars axes, and now Travis thought he understood why, because the guitar's hard, sharp notes seemed to split open his skull so the music could pour in and wash everything else out of his head. When Ronnie Van Zant began singing, Travis began to sing along. It was like the lyrics had been written for just how he felt this night. As Simon Frith does acknowledge, teens' musical choices can also enable them to demonstrate pride and self-assertion within their peer groups. The father against whom Travis rages does not listen to Black Oak Arkansas or the Allman Brothers, but Travis's rebel buddies Shank and Wesley do. And, you know, I'm kind of intrigued with the selection of these names, Shank and Wesley. I mean, we all know some good Mennonite Shanks, and you can't be much more pious than the Wesley brothers, but I don't think he's really doing anything with it, as much as I'm trying. This music definitely symbolizes the independence and toughness to which they aspire. So clearly, in The World Made Straight, the unskilled boys' preferred playlist is more than mere background music to their leisure activities. Tia DeNora's book, Music in Everyday Life, helped me see more clearly how Travis's use of music helps him counter, if only in his own mind, his father's assessment of him. Calling music a cultural vehicle, one that can be ridden like a bike or boarded like a train, DeNora suggests that listeners seek transport through it to different senses of identity. Music therapists, she points out, use the art form to afford patients with experiences that allow for the demonstration and self-perception of oneself in an aesthetic medium. Ordinary listeners, too, find ways to use music to similar ends. Building and deploying musical montages, DeNora writes, is part of a repertory of strategies for coping and generating pleasure, creating occasion, and affirming self and group identity. She elaborates, a great deal of identity work is produced as presentation of self to others, but the projection of biography is by no means the only basis for the construction of self-identity. Equally significant is a form of introjection, a presentation of self to self, the ability to mobilize and hold on to a coherent image of who one knows one is. Thus, in listening to powerful-sounding music and singing rebellious-sounding lyrics in the company of his reckless friends, Travis has a means of projecting rebelliousness and power, not only to impress others, but also to reassure himself. Such experiences, as Rash illustrates in The World Made Straight, are physiological as well as psychological and sociological. DeNora quotes from interviews with individuals who described venting through their use of music, concluding that the art form provides a way of transferring their means of expression from the real physical realm, hitting someone or doing something like kicking the door, punching a pillow, to the imagined, the virtual. Music thus provides a virtual reality within which respondents are able to express themselves in a symbolically violent manner, for example, by choosing aggressive or anti-establishment music, or by playing music at full volume. This virtual realm is a haven for angry individuals, DeNora says. Within this haven, they adopt the position of being in control of the symbolic and physical environment. Such listeners, DeNora notes, typically scorn headphones, for the point is to try to perpetrate a kind of aesthetic violence, to scream, punch, or kick musically, and thus to have power over one's aesthetic environment. It is also important to feel and respond to the physical character of this reality throughout one's body. That Travis wants Shank to raise the tape player's volume and find satisfaction in the way the guitar's hard, sharp notes seem to split open his skull illustrates DeNora's findings. Explaining that humans are continually responding to our environments, DeNora also describes medical uses of musical entrainment with premature babies, surgical, respiratory, and burn patients, and laboring mothers to achieve homeostasis, the regularization of physical and behavioral processes such as breathing, blood pressure, heartbeat, and sleep, and to manage pain. Music can help individuals achieve what DeNora calls bodily security, analogous to the security a nursing infant experiences when she latches onto her mother's breast. Positing that music offers an auditory latch to its listeners, DeNora asserts that it can be a resource for the constitution of embodied security, and its properties may afford such security. That Travis, a survivor of ongoing emotional and physical abuse by his father, as well as of a brutal crime, perpetrated by neighbors Carlton and Hubert Toomey, would seek bodily security through listening to music makes sense in this context. So this discussion of the pursuit of bodily security through musical listening helps account for the second way in which many people consume music, and that is if they might, the same way that they might consume a mood-altering substance. Noting that Jimi Hendrix once called music a safe kind of fix, Denora discusses at length music's potential to affect physiological processes. Music has a powerful capacity to affect internal mood, and Rash shows Travis and several other characters using music in much the same way that they drink and take drugs to cope with emotional pressure. Although Travis does not use marijuana or hard drugs when the book opens, he is, at 17, already a regular drinker and a heavy smoker. Pressured by Lori, he gives up cigarettes for a time, but feels a need as strong as thirst or hunger, and aches for them when he experiences stress. Strikingly, in both of the scenes in which he wants to hear Lynyrd Skynyrd, Travis also craves alcohol. After agonizing over his father's only noticing what didn't suit him in their farm co-labors, Travis figures a couple of beers might help mellow him out. A disturbing interaction with Dina drives him to dip into the amphetamines, or black beauties, to which she is devoted. He does not know their likely effect, but he does not care, as long as they made him feel different from the way he felt right now. Later, he goes riding with Shank and Wesley in search of illegal drugs, which leads to an explosive encounter with Carlton and Hubert Toomey. In Music, the Brain, and Ecstasy, How Music Captures Our Imaginations, Robert Jourdain discusses the link between drugs and music in a way that sheds light on Travis's addictive behaviors. He explains, "Before all else, people use music for mood enhancement. We take a certain kind of music to steer our central nervous system toward a particular condition. Hard rock as the frenzied rush of cocaine, easy listening genres as a martini, cheery supermarket music for a pick-me-up cup of coffee, cool jazz as a laid-back marijuana high, the far-flung landscape of classical music as the fantasy realm of psychedelics." So I'm interested to hear what James and Clement think of this later, and Ken. Jourdain goes on to discuss a research study using the drug naloxone, in which those who received the naloxone reported a substantially reduced pleasure in music they heard, while the control group experienced all the usual musical thrills. So music, Jourdain writes, is capable of delivering pleasure at virtually every level of our being. In This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of Human Obsession, Daniel J. Levitan explains how the same study revealed just how music affects different parts of the brain, from the auditory cortex to the frontal regions to the mesolimbic system involved in arousal, pleasure, and the transmission of opioids and the production of dopamine, culminating in the activation in the nucleus accumbens, the center of the brain's reward system, playing an important role in pleasure and addiction. The neck, as he calls it, is active when gamblers win a bet or drug users take their favorite drug. Ron Rash writes as if he understands these phenomena, if only intuitively, as he writes about Travis's and other characters' attempts to regulate mood through using both drugs and music in The World Made Straight. Dina, who is another character who does so, alternating between taking amphetamines and tranquilizers, has a past even more traumatic than Travis's. Rash leaves that past in shadows, but they are dark indeed. When Travis spies a scar on her shoulder, he knew that, as with him, someone had taken a knife to her flesh. About a different scar on Dina's arm, Lynyrd muses, she had never told him what caused that scar, just as she'd never explained her missing front teeth, but she'd told him enough about her life for him to know that neither had been an accident. Later, Lynyrd reflects on the significance of Dina's manicured fingernails. They were long and pointed, he muses, painted bright red like a warning. Sometimes they seemed to be what she cared about most, those hard, inflexible parts of her that could be cut into and feel nothing. She spoke rapidly and her hands moved restlessly from nail file to cigarette, switching the radio station as well whenever advertisements replaced music, all sure signs she'd been helping herself to the black beauties. As evidence of Travis's and Dina's traumatic pasts accumulate, their dependence on music, much like their dependence on mood-altering substances, also becomes increasingly evident. Dina is addicted to sex as well as drugs and music. She has moved in with Lynyrd in search of security, but she cannot overlook his continuing grief over his failed marriage. When he directs Dina to turn off the light before they make love, She says, "Why? So you can't see me. So you can pretend I'm somebody else. Probably that ex-wife of yours. You go to hell." Eventually, she begins sleeping with strangers. In his grief, Leonard, too, consumes music, much as he does mood-altering substances. He remembers playing the radio compulsively after Kira left him, taking Emily with her. Often, he'd leave the radio on all night, something to mask the emptiness if he couldn't sleep. He had done that until Dina moved in. Now he had all the background chatter he needed. The way it always was, Leonard reckoned, wanting what you no longer had, what you hadn't wanted when you did have it. There was truth in the title of the country song, "Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, Nobody Wants to Die." He struggles to remember who sang this Loretta Lynn's 1965 hit, knowing only with certainty that Johnny Cash, whose "I Still Miss Someone" has been playing on the radio, did not. Unfortunately, hearing the masterful Johnny Cash sing about heartbreak has not healed Leonard's pain. He reflects, no one else had a voice like that, smooth and rough at the same time, like water flowing over gravel. A voice capable of transforming sorrow and regret into something beautiful. Surely some consolation in that, Leonard thought, but not enough to keep Cash off the pills and out of the drunk tanks. A few pages later, as he struggles to fall asleep, Leonard tells himself he should have drunk more tonight, taken some pills as well, and fallen into a spinning, incoherent darkness. Clearly, Leonard and the younger Johnny Cash have quite a bit in common. Assuming that music has the potential to improve the listener's mood, the frequency with which Leonard listens to songs such as Cash's seems surprising. Leonard seeks music that would seem to deepen his misery. At one point in the novel, he reflects on the way his taste has changed over time. From having dismissed the country music his parents had played on the radio as too depressing, most lyrics a litany of yearning and regret, in favor, later, of the energy of Jerry Lee Lewis and Chuck Berry, later, the bliss and magnificence of classical music. But most recently, Leonard had come to appreciate country music's rough-hewn honesty. He remembered a Nashville writer who said that country music is three notes and a truth. Leonard's consumption of drinking and crying songs, three chords and the truth. Robert Jourdan's research helps account for Leonard's adult appreciation for the weepy songs his parents played when he was a boy still living at home. In considering the appeal of compositions that express negative emotions such as melancholy or grief or violence, Jourdan asserts, "We can make of music what we will. Music idealizes emotions, negative and positive alike. By so doing, it momentarily perfects our individual emotional lives. The meaning we feel is not in the music as such, but in our responses to the world, responses that we carry about with us always. Music serves to perfect those responses, to make them beautiful. By so doing, music imparts dignity to experience that is often far from dignified. And by imparting pleasure, even to negative emotions, music serves to justify sufferings large and small, assuring us that it has not all been for nothing." Kathleen Marie Higgins provides in The Music Between Us a complimentary account of unpleasant music's function, writing, "Ontological security is the presupposition of being able to confront disturbing emotions without being devastated by them. We take satisfaction in musical reflections of fear, sadness, and such, although we do not particularly enjoy these emotions in everyday life. By deliberately exposing oneself to emotions that might be disturbing, but savoring their progress and ultimate resolution, one expresses one's sense of mastery. In this respect, one asserts a sense of deep security in the face of challenges to one's repose." Leonard's consumption of drinking and crying songs, then, like Travis's of angry southern rock and Dina's frenetic radio station channel changing, is part of his search for identity. Leonard does have additional resources, however, that eventually enable him to emerge from his emotional abyss, but Dina is less fortunate. Although Leonard has afforded her some measure of physical protection by providing her with shelter, his own traumatic past renders him unable to reassure her about her value to him and her place in the world. When his growing sense of responsibility for Travis motivates him to stop drinking and selling beer and drugs to teenagers, Leonard also cuts off Dina's pill supply. Instead of following his example and getting clean, she shacks up with and begins selling drugs for the violent but vocally gifted Carlton Toomey and his son Hubert. Her profound insecurity leaves her intensely vulnerable to the temptations of mind-numbing drugs, dangerous sex, and a manipulative musician who plies her with both. And so he's our example of that third function of music in the novel, of manipulation. While Dina's horrifying move into the Toomey's house seems almost inevitable in light of her other self-destructive actions over the course of the novel, that she falls for the musically masterful Carlton Toomey is particularly noteworthy. I put that in there for Greta Ann, who loves puns, but I don't think she's here today. Rash suggests that Carlton holds sway over virtually everyone who hears him sing. He describes Carlton's performance of Wayfaring Stranger at the county fair this way. The musicians did not join in. They kept their hands at their sides, deferring to the power of Carlton Toomey's voice. It was his delicacy that Leonard found most disconcerting. The big man sang softly, the words easing from his mouth with the gentlest of phrasing. Toomey's eyes were closed, his hands clasped to his stomach like a man concealing some private wound. The midway's rambunctiousness became more distant as the people on the front row leaned slightly forward. Tears streamed down the face of the woman who sat next to Leonard as Carlton Toomey sang of crossing Jordan. Two nights later, Dina returns to Leonard's trailer with the Toomeys after a night of drinking with them. While she packs her overnight bag, Carlton taunts Leonard by telling him not to worry, saying, "We just want her for the weekend," and then boasting about the musical power he wields. "I saw you at the fair. From the look on your face, you hadn't reckoned I could sing that good. There's some who said I should have tried to make a go of it in Nashville, but it seemed too doubtful a way to make a living. I'd not do it for the money anyway. A few things in life ought to be done just to lighten folks' loads, and there ain't nothing that'll do that better than a good gospel song. I sung once at a big tent revival in Hot Springs, sang just as I am, and had them that was never saved and them that was backsliders all crying and getting right with the Lord. Even the preacher man claimed it was my singing more than his sermon brought him up front. The way I figure it, I've done enough good for the Lord that he'll cut me some slack in other areas, just like he did old King David." While Carlton's spiritual presumption is appalling, Rash makes him a fascinating figure, especially to readers interested in trauma, who can't help but wonder what that private wound is that he covers as he sings. In any case, he certainly demonstrates worship scholar Jeremy S. Begbie's warning in Faithful Feelings, Music and Emotion in Worship, that music's power is open to abuse, with manipulation as well as sentimentality and emotional self-indulgence among the ever-present dangers. The character Carlton Toomey understands this power without ever having had any formal study in musicology, psychology, or sociology, and Dina becomes his prey. As interesting as Rash's depictions are of his characters' uses of music to construct identity, regulate their emotions, and control others, the connections he draws between music and the hunger for heaven are the ones that are most striking to me. Having Leonard think about everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die is hardly a coincidence. Although Leonard can't remember the singer's name, the title comes to mind as he reflects on his life. Readers familiar with the song, which is on the mixtape you'll be hearing shortly, will realize at the novel's end that Rash has used it as a form of foreshadowing. While it, of course, summarizes the gospel's accounts of Christ's life, it also hints at aspects of Leonard's own fate. Moreover, the song, "Will There Be Any Stars in My Crown?" reverberates in both Leonard's and Carlton's consciousnesses, reflecting their shared preoccupation with eschatological matters. Among Carlton's most manipulative songs are those about crossing Jordan into the Promised Land. Dina may be particularly moved by them, having feared since she was 7 that she is hellbound. She tells Travis that you learn it early and you ain't allowed to forget. You even get to spend time there while you're still alive, just to give you a little taste of what's waiting. If G.K. Chesterton was right, though, and I think he is, in asserting that the man standing outside the brothel door is really seeking heaven, Dina's addictions to sex and drugs, as well as her use of music, demonstrate similarly futile searches for ecstasy. Although Leonard's own past is painful and his spiritual life is anything but settled, he draws from several resources that Dina has been denied, resources necessary not only for his emotional growth, but also in his pursuit of transcendence. First, he acquired from his mother a sense of wonder and creation. She would gaze from her porch steps at the mountains for long periods of time, telling him, "The prettiness of it takes me away from myself." And sometimes, a Bible or church just wasn't enough. That's why there's a need for a world in the first place, son. Second, his undergraduate history major equips him eventually to deal with the historical trauma that haunts him. Third, a liberal arts gen ed requirement made him a classical music lover. When Travis visits Leonard's rusty house trailer at the beginning of the novel, hoping to sell him marijuana plants he has poached from the Toomey's land, he is surprised to find Leonard, haggard and shaggy-haired, listening to Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring. Travis notes that the music coming from the speakers didn't have guitars or words. But he, unlike his buddy Shank, knows Leonard is poking fun at them when he claims the performers used to be the warm-up act for Leonard Skinner. Later, after Travis moves into the trailer with Leonard and Dina and comes to relate to Leonard almost as a son would, he asks, "How'd you start listening to that stuff anyway?" "My music appreciation professor in college, Dr. Haddon," Leonard said. "He'd lost a leg and half a hand at D-Day. I figured if a man who'd been through World War II found classical music important, I should at least give it a try." So classical music served as a source of consolation for the war vet music professor, as it eventually does for Leonard at critical moments in his own traumatic life. Leonard's particular appreciation for Handel's Messiah ultimately provides a key to understanding The World Made Straight. Although Leonard is not a conscious follower of Christ, his upbringing in a mountain church provided him with ample exposure to Scripture. That exposure, however, was insufficient for building a faith framework robust enough to accommodate his historical and personal traumas. He conceives of God as a detached and manipulative carnival worker, conducting humans on a meaningless and often dizzying ride, yet he craves meaning and stability. The novel is rife with disorientation imagery, from the tilted floor in Leonard's trailer, to apparently shifting stars above, to a sense of the world slipping away. Travis shares this perception, conceiving of himself on page 20, and then of the entire world on page 244 as off plumb. Frustrated by the instability of the world they inhabit, Travis and Leonard long instead for a world made straight. Leonard finds the promise of such a world in Handel's most famous composition. Slightly halfway through the novel, Rasch reveals that the title itself is an allusion to Handel's Messiah. Rasch describes a morning in the trailer during which Leonard turns to his LP of the oratorio for comfort after ruminating over having lost Kira and Emily. Travis ate his cereal as Leonard listened to "For Unto Us a Child is Born." The choral voice is tentative, as though afraid to speak the truth. God come to earth as a child. These uncertain voices were the direct opposite of the bombast of the symphony's conclusion. That was the wonder of it, Leonard knew. The balance of the thing, everything countered, not just balanced, but reconciled, as the tenor voices resonated below the ethereal sopranos. Even the words proclaimed an order, "The crookedness of the world made straight." It was, Leonard recognized, such a magnificent order as to demand devotion, the same kind of devotion his mother had shown as she embraced the world from her porch steps. This passage illustrates the phenomenon Robert Jourdan describes in Music, the Brain, and Ecstasy. He writes, "The world is an untidy place. Where we would like to find simple patterns and deep connections, we encounter complexity and conflict and confusion. And so all ordinary existence is accompanied by a certain amount of strain. Only in a handful of activities, including music and other arts, do our minds partake of experience that is so perfectly organized that every anticipation is roundly satisfied, filling us with intense pleasure. Many people say that it is beauty alone that draws them to music, but great music brings us even more. But by providing the brain with an artificial environment and forcing it through that environment in controlled ways, music imparts the means of experiencing relations far deeper than we encounter in our everyday lives. In this perfect world, our brains are able to piece together larger understandings than they can in the workaday external world, perceiving all-encompassing relations that go much deeper than those we find in ordinary experience. It's for this reason that music can be transcendent. For a few moments, it makes us larger than we really are, and the world more orderly than it really is. We respond not just to the beauty of the sustained deep relations that are revealed, but also to the fact of our perceiving them. As our brains are thrown into overdrive, we feel our very existence expand and realize that we can be more than we normally are, and that the world is more than it seems. That is cause enough for ecstasy. Jourdan asserts that musical ecstasy is more than extreme pleasure. It melts the boundaries of our being, reveals our bonds to the external world, engulfs us in feelings that are oceanic. Or as Leonard's mother described it, in a more straightforward way perhaps, speaking about her experiences in nature, "The prettiness of it takes me away from myself." In context of our consideration of the world made straight, Jordan's use of the term oceanic seems uncanny, for Leonard undergoes a final mystical experience in nature of music, imagined and remembered, that is oceanic. Having found the courage to defy the Toomies in a final fatal showdown, Leonard lies bleeding in a creek. He thinks about the beauty of leaves and then observes fog as it develops. Whether this fog is a meteorological phenomenon or the result of his blood loss, Leonard nevertheless glimpses in it unhurried, delicate movements that remind him of something he'd seen before, but the fog seemed to have worked into his mind, making everything harder to find. Minutes passed before he remembered Professor Haddon's last class at Chapel Hill, the motion of his teacher's maimed hand as it followed the music. Here, Rash harkens back to a scene he described over 100 pages earlier, Leonard's memory of the last day of music appreciation class. Professor Haddon sat in the corner and raised his mangled right hand as the overture of the Messiah began. Three fingers and half a palm waved slowly back and forth, a calm, stroking motion. When the record ended, Professor Haddon stood before the class and said his final words, holding his right hand up, what remained of his palm open as though to absolve them. "There is beauty in this world," he told them, "more beauty than any of us can fathom, and we must not ever forget this." Remembering this moment yet again as the fog deepens, Leonard has a remarkable vision. Rather than despair in the face of death, he anticipates being raised by the creek waters as they lift the weight from his body, lifting him from the pain as well. They will, he anticipates, carry him all the way down the French Broad and on west to the Ohio and the Mississippi, all the way to the ocean and across the ocean and to the beach where his daughter Emily waited. And he would have her tell him every single thing that had happened since he last saw her. And he would not stop listening until every day and every hour had been accounted for. And then they would wait for rain, and only then walk above the beach where plants grew and find some frond or fern that held a bead of water. And he would gently cup in his hand the plant and show her more than he could ever tell her, a pearl of rain held in his open palm. Remembering the Messiah while exulting in the water flowing around him, even in death, Leonard demonstrates the capacity that Marcia Herndon and Norma McLeod describe in their book, Music as Culture, that capacity of music to give us two powerful experiences, flash, which involves heightened awareness of anything else in the environment, and flow, in which one loses self-awareness and any sense of separation from the object. As powerfully poetic as Leonard's death scene is, the passage does not, of course, depict his salvation in any conventionally Christian sense. Rash himself is cagey about his theological commitments, expressing gratitude for his Southern Baptist upbringing, but preferring now to write and speak more broadly about wonder than about the gospel. I do think, however, that he offers the hope of Travis's moving toward actual Christian commitment in the book's final paragraph. But rather than spoil the conclusion for you by explaining now, I'll just invite you to read the book and then my argument in the Crescent. Leonard's final vision, however, still illustrates a reality that Stephen R. Guthrie explores in Creator Spirit. And acknowledging the wealth of songs Christians sing about heaven, as well as those songs' emphases on beauty, perfection, and completion, Guthrie points out that sometimes singing with others, sometimes standing in the midst of an extraordinary architectural structure, or listening as the last words of a poem are read, we feel we have caught a glimpse of a better world, or perhaps that we have seen a small piece of this world perfected. This is how things are meant to be, we might say. Or perhaps, in a perfect world, this is how things would look. This is how things would sound. Truly great art, Guthrie asserts, doesn't merely depict beauty, however. It acknowledges the world's brokenness, too. He quotes from Milan Kundera's description of kitsch, or art that hides reality, asserting that kitsch is the absolute denial of shit, in both the literal and figurative senses of the word. Kitsch excludes everything from its purview which is essentially unacceptable to human existence. Surely, he would admire Rash's boldness in depicting honestly violence in families and among neighbors, as well as various forms of addiction. The beauty in Rash's fiction is in the hope it offers that this chaos can be overcome. Christians look to Christ's return as the ultimate overcoming. Guthrie calls it the consummation of history, vindication of the righteous, the judgment of the wicked, the undoing of death and corruption, and the uniting of all things under the reign of God. Drawing also from Miroslav Wolf, he asserts that the eschatological good of shared history necessarily includes scars and shared suffering. The resurrected world bears the marks of history, even tragic history, in part because these wounds are the testimony of God's presence in the midst of his people across time. Because of this, even they share the character of the new creation. As I read to you earlier, Guthrie contends that a Christian eschatology asserts that history, humanity, and the cosmos look forward not only to an ending, but to a telos, a completion, fulfillment, and a kind of perfection. To hope for the kingdom of God in its fullness is to hope for beauty. Thus, I offered to the men at Gemeinschaft Home, and offer now to you, and will offer to a group of students in the spring, the work of this writer, Ron Rash, whose fiction you will never find in a Christian bookstore. Whether you struggle with addiction or are a companion to someone who does, whether you study trauma and its effects, whether you love music, you will find much in Rash's work to appreciate. It, in bearing witness to creation's brokenness, he also reminds us of its beauty too, marred now, but perfected in our longings, and someday throughout creation in God's good time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Marty, for a really interesting talk. You're clearly both smart and good with titles. And you've also given us a really good example, I think, of something I know you care a lot about, which is the integration of faith and scholarship. So thanks for that. We have time now for about 10 minutes for questions and response or comments. But I would invite you to please make your comments in front of the microphone because we're putting this on a podcast and we want to get it on the recording. Are you okay with just fielding questions yourself?
And I do want to communicate thanks also to James Richardson, who during his time from EMU to work on his PhD, read the novel and just wrote me this wonderful email about so many things that are going on musically. And I didn't try to import those into this paper, but I want to develop this for another project, and I know I'm going to draw from James's insights. So, but he doesn't deserve blame for any problems. Does anybody have a question? Yes, Esther, right?
Just curious, how did you first discover Ron Rash?
My first memory of seeing anything by Ron Rash was in a bookstore in Boone, North Carolina that had been my father's furniture store. When my father retired, a bookstore owner bought the building. And I remember there was a stack of books by Ron Rash, and I picked this one up, and I read the back cover and thought, oh, that is too violent. I can't read that. Then later I heard him read poetry, and he was a fabulous reader and presenter, and I read a couple of other of his books. And I got to interview him last summer and knew that his grandmother's name was Green, and my maiden name was Green. And he spent his summers very near my childhood home, and so I asked a friend who does a lot of genealogical work to see if we were related and how, and he said we were sixth cousins two different ways. So, that's more than you ask, but I love to tell it. Yes, Roxy. I think your voice would carry.
Well, on a podcast.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
So thank you very much. My question is, when you were working with this book, how did the students at Gemeinschaft respond to some of the music, using music to deal with trauma? Did you kind of tease that out in your classes with them?
Well, I used a collection of short stories by Rash at Gemeinschaft, assuming that to take a long work with a population of people who would be changing wouldn't work so well. But he has at least one short story where music is just as important. We didn't actually read that one. But Miss Shirley, are you still here? Do you remember, did we talk about music? Okay. Yes. We started with the funny ones, and the by you know this guy who's so down on his luck, and his wife has left him. And then we looked at one set in the 19th century that's about a Civil War era pastor who's dealing with guilt for staying out of the Civil War. So we sort of moved our way toward guilt and forgiveness with that. And then we really got into stories about serious addiction. There was one in which a little boy is trying to care for his parents who are addicted to meth. They buy him a bicycle and then they sell it right away. And I think that evening's discussion was our most challenging. Some of the men got really worked up in disagreement with each other about whether the little boy's parents were totally cruel or if they did love him in some way. And it seems obvious to me that they do. I think Rash treats them with great compassion. But some of the men were just, they just couldn't believe these parents would let this little boy suffer as he does in the story. Any other questions? Yes, Ms. Shirley. I don't know. I'll have to think about that one. That's what Marty King said I should say if I didn't know the answer to a question, right? That's a very good question. I don't know, but you know, there is this tradition of the music of the spheres, right? That all of existence and the cosmos might be ordered in some way that is musical. Ken Jay, what do you think? Is he still here? No? Oh yeah, what do you think? Oh. James, or is Clement still here? Anybody? It's not an either-or answer, and it's the mystery of the relationship that keeps drawing us back. Is that right, Ken? More or less. Maybe you're eager to hear the mixtape. Well, thank you again very much for coming.
We have time now for a short reception with light refreshments that I hope are there. Lois, you're here. Okay, good. She got called away at the last minute, so I was panicking a little bit that maybe they hadn't arrived, but they're here. And I also wanted to mention next month's colloquium, October 19, will be Scott Stredneck Singer. He's a scholar from Temple University who does stuff on, is Nancy here, Nancy Heise? On sport and religion and masculinity. It should be very interesting. His title is Embodiment, Ethics, and Christian Athletics. So I'm sure David King will be here at least, but I hope the rest of you will come and tell others as well. I think it's going to be a really interesting talk. So thank you again, Marty. Thank you all for coming. Enjoy the reception.